Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. In the first century AD, the Greek historian and biographer Plutarch wrote this about Athens before the rise of democracy. Quote, "Disparity between rich and poor had culminated into a perilous condition. All the common people were in debt to the rich. For not paying their debts, they could become slaves at home or sold to a foreign land. Many, too, were forced to sell their children or go into exile because of the cruelty of the moneylenders." Plutarch was writing in a time when democracy was a distant memory. The Greek world in his day was in the fold of the Roman Empire. Also a distant memory, but not forgotten, was the inequality that led to the revolts. Plutarch also wrote this, quote, "But the most and sturdiest of the poor began to band together and exhort one another not to submit to their wrongs, but to choose a trusty man as their leader, set free the condemned debtors, redistribute the land, and overthrow the government." We don't know the names of the poor, but if true, and we'll never know if it's not, these are revolutionary words. This was the poor thinking about overthrowing the oligarchs and taking their land. This is the time when coinage as currency begins its widespread use, and as the saying goes, money changes everything, for better and for worse. It can be argued that money and the market system it produced in Athens made the great cultural explosion of theater, sports, philosophy, and even democracy itself possible, but it also made debt possible, and that was the underlining reality for the Athenian masses. In the ancient world, when the poor could not pay their debt to the rich, they sold themselves and even their families into slavery. This happened so often that a significant portion of the population was certainly facing debt slavery, and when that happens, revolt becomes inevitable. It's the 7th century BCE when we pick up the telling of this story of the oldest fully formed democracy that we know of in ancient Athens, a democracy that was born out of class struggle. This extreme inequality in the 7th century BCE, which means the 600s BCE, brought in the era of the demagogue, that trusty man that Plutarch referenced to lead the people. Today, the word demagogue means a person who exploits the fears and prejudices of the masses and aims their animosity towards a scapegoat, which could be everything from the ruling elites to an ethnic minority. Today, the word is a pejorative. It's a negative term. We use it negatively towards people that we think are exploiting the prejudices and fears of ordinary people. But the old Greek word demagogue, however, meant something different. It meant leader of the people. Demos, again meaning the people, and agogos, meaning to lead the people, demagogue. A successful demagogue who harnessed the discontent from the poor to overthrow the aristocratic rule and insert himself as the sole ruler then became the tyrant. The word tyrant from Old Greek, tyrannus, means a ruler who obtained power unconstitutionally by overthrowing the previous regime. But unlike its use today as an oppressive ruler, in the ancient world, a tyrant rose to power on the backs of the poor and were indebted to the poor and frequently tried to at least look to be good on that debt to the poor. It is interesting that both these words, demagogue and tyrant, are pejoratives today, are negative terms today. But if you look at their origins in the ancient Greek language, and if you look at this history of democracy, they are actually both figures, questionable, not saints, certainly, but they were figures that sided with the poor. Of course, America, United States, has developed its own democratic system, but it's very clear in the Constitutional Convention, just after the founding of the Republic, that they were concerned about mob rule, about the poor ruling, because in ancient Athens, democracy did mean the poor ruled. Because the majority of the people were poor. And you definitely hear in the Constitutional Convention and you read in the Federalist Papers afterwards in the debate over ratifying the Constitutional Convention, you certainly hear a concern about how to keep the poor from ruling in American democracy. But I digress. This first account of a demagogue who would become the tyrant came from the 7th century BCE. By a man named Cylon. Cylon was a great Olympic champion. His athletic achievements made him famous throughout the Mediterranean world. His fame knew no bounds. He was like a popular sports athlete today, or a movie star, or perhaps even a television personality. The ancient poet Pindar was known for composing verses in praise of athletes, and he wrote this just to give you a taste of what it meant to be a great athlete. He wrote, quote, "Life was filled with pain and ended with the defeat of death, but a triumph of an athlete in bloom offered a kind of immortality." Other than political power, it was through really athletic competition that one could gain such fame. And in 632 BCE, Cylon tried to grow this fame by attempting to overthrow the land-owning ruling elites and instituting himself as tyrant. Now, long ago, Athens had been done with a monarchic form of rule. It was the land-owning elites that formed the aristocracy that ruled the day and had done so for some time. This aristocracy had its own political institutions as well, in which it shared power amongst itself. They even held elections in which they could only vote in for positions known as archons, in which a victorious aristocrat would oversee a specific sector of society, say like a magistrate would. The word archon meant ruler in the old Greek language, and there would be about 9 of them at any given time. The word archon is also the base word for another word that we commonly use today, and that's anarchy, which means no rulers. There was another and perhaps even more important political body. It was called the Areopagus. It was made up exclusively of former archons, so former leaders, and was considered to be, quote-unquote, the guardian of the laws. It determined what the laws were, and it also would hold accountable the current serving archons. Think of it as sort of a combined Supreme Court and Senate with absolute authority. Cylon believed, with his attempted coup, that the poor masses would rise up and join him in overthrowing the ruling elite. But they did not, and his coup failed. After the failed attempt, he and his supporters fled to the Acropolis in Athens, the rocky hill where today the iconic ruins of the Parthenon sits, for religious refuge at the Temple of Athena. Cylon eventually escaped, and he fled Athens, but his supporters, still holed up in the temple, were told that their lives would only be spared if they came out and stood trial. So they did as they were told, but instead of being tried, they were stoned to death, likely a warning to all others who would even think of overthrowing the current regime. Why the poor masses didn't rise up to support Cylon's coup is unknown. Perhaps the number of people ready to revolt had not reached sufficient numbers. We understand that. Or because they just didn't trust Cylon. Maybe they could see that he was acting in his own best interest while feigning about the cause of the people, which is, of course, a common trait of the demagogue, even a common trait of the politician. But what is clear is the attempted coup ushered in a new era of struggle between the aristocrats and the tyrants, or would-be tyrants. Cylon wouldn't be the last to try a coup, and the ones to come would be actually successful. Over the next 100 years, a power struggle between aristocrats and tyrants took turns in overthrowing one another, each time needing the people's help to do it. And this was significant because each time promising the people a little more involvement in running the state's affairs. Athenian democracy did not come about in a single revolution, but instead through a series of reforms that the people were promised with each new overthrow of a previous regime. And these gains added up over the years to where eventually the people, meaning those recognized as citizens, had power. Democracy did not come by revolution, but it came by a long series of reforms. Cylon's coup attempt shook the rich. They saw the discontent coming from below and knew something had to be done to ease the tensions in order to secure their own standings and to protect their own wealth from another coup. A likely common complaint from the people, from the poor at the time, was that the rules, the laws, they were arbitrary. They were whatever the elite said they were at any given time. They weren't codified and they weren't written down so that everyone could actually follow them, including the ruling elite themselves. So they brought in a fellow aristocrat to codify and write down the laws, literally in stone, and place these stone tablets around town for everyone to see, everyone to be able to read, and everyone to understand what exactly were the laws that everyone was supposed to follow. And this was significant because once everyone had an understanding of what the laws were, well, they're harder to contradict. even for the rulers. Doesn't mean they weren't manipulated by the powerful, they were, as they are now, but it still made it harder just to outright contradict the laws without everyone seeing the contradictions. And of course, you understand, laws are also meant to protect their wealth, and if you completely ignore the laws and don't follow them yourselves, then you are hurting the credibility of the system that actually protects you. So it was important for the rich as well, but it was also important for the masses because it took a little bit of this arbitrary approach to what the law was away and made it more standardized. That fellow aristocrat's name who came in to write the laws was Draco, and his name would be immortalized in our modern-day use of the word draconian. Draco's laws are remembered not for the order that they imposed, but for the severity of the punishment inflicted on those who broke the laws. Plutarch wrote that Draco's laws had the same penalty for every violation, no matter how big or small, and that that penalty was death. Those convicted of idleness were put to death. Those who stole food were also put to death, and it was the same punishment for those who committed homicide, death. There is a story that Draco himself was asked why he made the death penalty for all offenses, and he replied, quote, "The lesser ones deserved it, and for the greater crimes there is, regrettably, no heavier penalty to be found." Quintessential hard ass there. Like many ancient stories, the evidence and mentions we have of Draco are well after his death. His response to the severity of penalty and breaking his laws is likely apocryphal. There is a debate as to whether Draco even existed at all. The truth is, there is a debate about almost all of ancient history because so little of its evidence has actually survived and has been found. And the authors of the few writings we still do have were as flawed as we are today, and they held their own biases, motivations, made their fair share of mistakes that should keep us always skeptical about how accurate our understanding of the ancient world is. But it is what we have, and they still do show us that these stories are meaningful. And of course, history is always as much about the time it is being written in, or like today, being talked about, as the time that it actually occurred. Enjoy listening to Letters and Politics on listener-sponsored KPFA in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today is part two of a three-part series in which I will be telling you about the history of Athenian democracy, the oldest fully formed democracy that we know of from 2,500 years ago. Today we are focusing on how democracy was born out of a class struggle. I want to give you a quick update towards that challenge that Daryl in Piedmont put up for us this morning. As I speak to you, we have raised $260 towards that $2,000 challenge. This is a very big deal for us because if we can make this $2,000 challenge by the end of the hour, Daryl will put in $2,000, and friends, that is going to be $4,000. It's a big deal. It gives me cover, helps makes this, increases the likelihood of this effort that we're putting in, this endeavor that we have embarked upon of being successful. Of course, I'm asking for something special. I'm asking you for your support. That's a big deal. It's something you would give voluntarily. And in return for that, I wanted to try to do something special. Doesn't mean it's special. Doesn't mean it won't work. Doesn't mean it will work. Doesn't mean it'll go off well. Doesn't mean you'll like it. I get all that, right? But I wanted to go for it. I wanted to try. And this is not how the show will always be because this took a lot of work, believe me. But this is what we're trying to do. We think it's important. We believe in bringing something to the air that's educational and hopefully with a good story. You know, whether it's a good story or not, you could be the judge. But if you take out a pen and write some of this stuff down that I'm talking about, you will educate yourself about the first fully formed democracy that we know of. Doesn't mean that there weren't others, but this is the one that we know of. And in return, if you have found any value in this, I'm asking you to pledge what you can according to what you can. If you're interested in a book, my favorite book on this topic is from the great 20th century muckraking journalist I.F. Stone called The Trial of Socrates. It's fantastic. There's only a few left. We have limited editions of them, but we are offering them to you for a pledge of $100. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org. That's for KPFA and KFCF listeners. For KPFK listeners in Southern California, the number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. Now back to the program. So Draco wrote down the laws, and it may have temporarily quelled the unrest, like lifting the lid off a boiling pot, but it did not alleviate the inequality that caused the turmoil to begin with. The law still favored the wealthiest of Athenians, and it gave great power to the creditors over the debtors. 30 years later, so remember, these people, many of these people are in debt slavery. So 30 years later, societal turmoil caused by inequality and debt slavery was back. So a new generation of aristocratic leaders did what their parents did with Draco. They brought in a different man, not to write down the laws this time, but to rewrite the laws. It was a man who also came from the ruling class and had the confidence of the aristocrats. But unlike Draco, he was known also as a friend to the poor, and his name was Solon. And Solon won an election, became the chief archon, and was given additional powers to create a new constitution in an attempt to keep Athens from erupting into a civil war that's being driven by inequality. He had the confidence of the oligarchs because he was one of them. It's also written he had the confidence of the poor masses because he secretly told them, or perhaps deceptively told them, he would go as far as redistributing the land. Solon was also a poet, and remarkably, many of his poems still survive today. And in these poems, you hear he was a man who could see how the excesses of the rich was leading to the decay of almost every aspect of civic life that was bringing the city to ruins. Here's a quote from one of his poems. "Unrighteous is the mind of the leaders, and their pride goes before a fall, for they know not how to hold them from excess, nor to direct in peace the jolly of their present feasting, but grow rich through unrighteous deeds. This is a wound that comes to every city, and she falls quickly into an evil servitude, which arouses discord and awakens the slumbering war that destroys the lovely prime of so many men." Solon was respected, so respected that it said he had every opportunity to turn his archonship into the rule of a single tyrant, but he refused to do so, telling an acquaintance, quote, "A tyranny was a lovely place, but there was no way down from it." In other words, once a tyrant, the only way out was through death. The first thing he set out to do as archon was to relieve the pressures on the poor. In a remarkable move, he canceled all debt, and he abolished debt slavery. That is no small feat, and the wealthy elites were not happy about it. But what could they do, as Solon was really the only one standing between them and the angry masses? In a surviving poem, he wrote this, quote, "I stood with a mighty shield in front of both classes." It is reminiscent of the time when the rich complained to Franklin D. Roosevelt about the New Deal during the Great Depression, and FDR responded that he was the only one standing between them and the angry mob with pitchforks. The New Deal is actually a great modern example of when the ruling class had to give up a little bit just to save itself. That's what these reforms from Athenian aristocrats 2,600 years ago were also about, saving themselves from a violent uprising from the masses. Abolishing debt slavery and forgiving existing debt was a radical move. It wasn't abolishing slavery altogether. That was still there. But if it was concerning debt, it was over. And also, all debt was eliminated. Another pretty radical move. But Solon was not a radical. His measures were based more on ideas of justice and moderation. He did not keep his promise to redistribute land, and he ensured that the aristocrats stayed in power. So like most moderate reforms, no one was truly happy. And he actually came under great criticism when a scandal broke out over his reforms. Before the reforms were made public, Solon told some of his friends that he planned to forgive debt and protect private property. So these friends of his took full advantage of this knowledge and acquired big loans in order to buy land. And once Solon's reforms were enacted, they refused to pay off the loans, knowing the debt would be canceled and that the land that they bought from those loans would also be protected, sort of an ancient version of insider trading. Obviously, this was a bad look for Solon. But it is written that he survived the fallout. And the reason he survived the fallout was because he himself forgave all the people who owned him in debt. So in the end, he walked the walk, which actually in the end goes a long way for a lot of people who are expected to behave in the same way. Again, if they wanted to avoid a civil war, this was probably their best chance to do it. So far, these reforms, while important, are not what we would call democratic. It's this one last reform where we can begin to see the early signs of democracy. Solon created a new political and legislative body, which is called the Bule. It was a council of 400 people. And for the first time, Solon allowed those who were not born into the ruling class, but who were wealthy nonetheless, sort of the wealthier of the masses, and owned land, allowed those people to serve in the Bule. In other words, the bourgeoisie. There was a land-owning requirement to serve, so the vast majority of the people were not allowed to participate. But again, of the masses who were previously excluded from power, those who had more money, those who were richer, those who owned land within the bigger masses, those folks now were suddenly brought into the ruling ranks. And so everybody else was still left out, but it was still an expansion. It was enfranchisement of some people, basically the bourgeoisie, that weren't allowed to participate in the first place. Most revolutions are actually led by this class of people, the people who are wealthy but have been locked out of power. And this, in ancient Athens, would be the first of many expansions to come. This legislative body, again, it's called the Bule, set the agenda for the popular assembly. The assembly is the oldest democratic body we know of. The Greek word for it was ecclesia, which also has a religious tone to it, which is interesting, but ecclesia mostly means to call out. You call out and then people come, and in democracy, this assembly, people come in order to make a decision. And as we have seen, it goes as far back as the Greek myth. The assembly, again, is any gathering of people called on to make a decision. Now, I've yet to talk about this popular assembly, and while it's believed it existed during and through oligarchic rule in the 7th century BCE, we don't really know when it began and what powers it had. Because we are lacking sources about it during these early years, it's easy to think that maybe it not been that powerful at all. Perhaps the elites just allowed it to give the masses a sense of civic involvement. We don't know. Or maybe the elites purposefully wrote it out of history because of the danger it and the idea of it presented to the ruling class. What we do know is the idea of an assembly is old. So old we don't have a beginning for it. And with time, this assembly becomes more and more important, more and more powerful, to where it inevitably becomes the most democratic and powerful body of them all. After these reforms, Solon stepped down as archon and went into a self-imposed exile for the next 10 years so that nobody could lobby him to make changes. So he travels the world. Herodotus gives us a great account of his journeys, including a conversation with King Croesus, the richest man in the world, the king of Lydia, who kept asking Solon who was the luckiest man on earth, in which he expected Solon to say, well, the king himself. But Solon did not give in to the king's desire, instead said, it's impossible to know who had a lucky life until you know how they died. There are different accounts of how Croesus died, but two of them are suicide and the other being burned alive at the stake. This is Letters in Politics, and I just want to give you a quick fundraising update towards that $2,000 challenge that came in from Daryl in Piedmont. At the very moment, we've raised $760 towards that $2,000 challenge. We have about 13, 14 minutes to go to try to raise the remainder of that money to get this challenge of $2,000, which would mean $4,000 for this hour. It would also mean that everyone who donates this hour will have their donation doubled up to that $2,000 mark. It also means we make our goal. Not only do we make our goal, but we go over it a little bit, and that means it gives us, it starts to average out from our shortcoming last week. So it's an important day for us, and we're trying to bring something important to the air. Of course, you, in the end, will be the judge of whether we have achieved that or not. I ask for a donation that you can afford, it's according to your means, and that you feel good about, knowing that you did your part in supporting this historic radio station. For our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area listening to KPFA in Berkeley, the phone number, and this is also true for KFCF listeners in the Central Valley, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, the phone number you're going to call is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. If you are interested in a thank you gift, we're offering one of my favorites. It's this book. It's one of my favorite books. If you look at mine, it's all beat up because I've spent so much time with it and gone over it and have underlined so many different passages in it. And it's one of 15 books I used to prepare for this presentation that we're doing over 3 days. The book is The Trial of Socrates, and it's written by the great muckraking journalist I.F. Stone of the 20th century, an iconoclast himself. The Izzy Award for independent media is named after I.F. Stone, just to give you a sense of who he was. This was the last book he wrote. Because of failing health later on in his life, he retired. But in that retirement, he went back to school and basically became a classicist and studied this period of time very closely and wanted to know, how is it that they executed this man, Socrates, in an open society in which debate was expected, right? In which free speech was valued. How does he, and what happens? It's because the democratic system had been overthrown several times just before the trial, and he was a teacher of those who actually tried to overthrow it, even though he didn't participate in it himself. It's really a complicated and fascinating story. We'll get more into that tomorrow, but we are offering the book for a contribution of $100. Limited supplies, so you got to move on it quick. The phone number for KPFA listeners in Northern California and also Central California for KFCF listeners, you all call the same number, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. Back to the show. While Solon forevermore has been remembered as the lawgiver, his reforms did not hold the peace. People were freed from debt bondage, but great inequality persisted, and people always yearned for more. The vast majority of the people were still shut out politically, so unrest was once again on the rise, and a demagogue once again stepped in to direct the discontent from below towards the ruling elite, and, unlike Cylon, this time was successful in overthrowing the aristocracy, and he put himself in power as the tyrant. His name was Pisistratus. We talked about him yesterday in Democracy's Creation Story, which I like to call the Tyrannicides, the killer of the tyrants. Pisistratus gained the support of the poor, and he rewarded them well for it with limited land distribution and money to develop that land. He also allowed the rich to have a modicum of power so long as they accepted his absolute rule, while those who did not went into exile. But when he died, his sons took over, and as so often happens, didn't rule as capably. So they were overthrown in a wild story that included a homosexual love triangle, terrorism, and a political assassination. This would become Democracy's founding myth story. That's the story I told yesterday, so I'm skipping it here for time's sake and also to avoid repetition. The landed elite would eventually overthrow the tyrannical rule of Pisistratus' sons with the help of Athens' rival, Sparta. Sparta reinstituted aristocratic rule that was favorable to it. But within this ruling class, and this is important, two political leaders with their own factions behind them rose to prominence and became fierce political foes. Their names were Isagoras and Cleisthenes. Isagoras grew his support from Sparta and the aristocrats. But Cleisthenes, who was one of those elites who went into exile during Pisistratus' rule, you could say became a traitor to his class. He drew his support from the poor. In 508 BCE, with the backing of Sparta and the ruling elite, Isagoras won the election for the top archon position. Important to remember, only the elites got to vote in such an election. But it must have been extremely contentious before Isagoras' victory, because after the election, Isagoras, with the military support of Sparta behind him, forced Cleisthenes and about 700 of his supporters into exile. Clearly, they were still seen as a threat to Isagoras' rule. But Isagoras didn't stop there. He also tried to dissolve the political gains achieved for the masses by undoing the boule. Again, the boule, this legislative body of 400 people that was created by Solon, he tried to dissolve it. But the boule resisted. And the people, even though the vast majority of them were shut out of the boule from participating, only the wealthy who had previously been locked out of power were able to serve in the boule at this point. Nonetheless, it was still considered an advancement, and people, regular people, who were locked out, still rose up to defend it. They must have had their swords, clubs, daggers, and pitchforks, because Isagoras and about 300 of his supporters were forced to flee once again to the Acropolis, where they took refuge for 3 days as they were surrounded by throngs of angry people. Again, the Acropolis is this giant rocky hill that's easy to defend from above. And on that third day, a deal was brokered and Isagoras was allowed safe passage into exile. But his supporters were executed. Cleisthenes was summoned back and he was declared leader. And he was given special powers to institute a new set of reforms in an attempt, once again, to stave off a civil war. His first act was to commission the creation of the statues of Harmodius and Aristogiton, known as the Tyrannicides, the tyrant killers, talked about them yesterday. And the statues ensured that these gay lovers, 3, 2, 1. And the statues ensured that these gay lovers would be remembered for committing the deed that made democracy possible. Again, they were placed right in the middle of the agora, the city center, where no other statues were allowed to even be near. Again, as I said, I told this story yesterday. I wish I knew this story when I was a Capitol Hill reporter. When I was a Capitol Hill reporter is when Republicans were trying to pass a constitutional amendment to make marriage between only a man and a woman. And to know that in democracy's creation story, that the two heroes were two gay men, I just would have loved to have been able to ask questions about that, about, you know, you're extolling the virtues of democracy today, yet you are bringing this anti-gay, anti-homosexual legislation to the Senate floor. Doesn't that even contradict with the history of democracy itself when its mythical past? It's more of an apocryphal story than, I guess, a mythical story. But that these two gay lovers, Harmodius and Aristogiton, were considered the heroes of democracy that made democracy possible. It's a real overstatement to say that's actually what happened, but that was the story that Athenians told themselves in a time of democracy. These were their two heroes, Harmodius and Aristogiton, and they were gay. And I just wish I knew that 15 years ago when I was a Capitol Hill reporter. But for further and more meaningful reforms, Cleisthenes had a major problem on his hands. Reformers before him also made substantial changes but failed to solve the inequality problem that led to social unrest, and he realized, I believed, the biggest obstacle to change was the ruling class itself. They had the most to lose and still, even after the previous reforms, had the most power. The elite stuck together when they knew that their shared interest was at stake. So in something that hadn't been tried before, Cleisthenes moved to break them up, to break up their political power by pitting them against one another. And he did it in such an excessive manner that you could describe it in a modern way as perhaps extreme gerrymandering. Gerrymandering that maybe even would make today's Republicans blush. Maybe. It's a complicated system that I would be foolish to try to describe in detail, but basically he replaced kinship political networks with 10 new political tribes that were based on geography, hence dividing up the wealthy into different tribes while lumping the interest of a diverse cross-section of society into each tribe. This act of super gerrymandering basically diffused a lot, though not all, of the political power that the elites had. So how did Cleisthenes get away with it? Well, I'm assuming the ruling elite saw how the hungry masses with weapons just ran out the previous aristocratic rule and the rulers. They knew at the moment they probably didn't have much of a choice, and if they didn't go along with it, the game was up. The second reform by Cleisthenes was to take the boule, again this legislative body that set the agenda for the popular assembly, and expand it from 400 people to 500, and opened up further who could serve in it. The members came in equal representation from their new tribes, and they were chosen each year by lot. What that means is they were not elected, but chosen randomly, hence eliminating the influence that money could have in an election. Think of it like jury duty, though it was voluntary. Each member had a short term limit, and hence the boule opened up to a lot of people to serve in it. The third, and this might be the most important reform, Cleisthenes opened up the popular assembly to all citizens regardless of wealth and property ownership status. It was opened up to the poor, and a lot of people could participate at it at any given time. It was open to everyone, and the hill where it met, just off the agora in downtown Athens, called the Pnyx, held up to about 6,000 people. And the assembly decided with a popular vote almost every major issue that the boule presented to it. Can be argued that these three reforms is where Athenian democracy was born. It was a direct democracy, unlike our representational democracy. The people voted on every major decision, including questions of war and peace. There was one last reform by Cleisthenes that's peculiar and worth talking about. That's ostracism. This is where we get our modern word to ostracize, to cast someone out. But ostracism in ancient Athens was a political act. Every year, the people would decide whether to have an ostracism vote. Most years, they didn't. It was seldomly used. But when they did, the question would be put to the people, what single individual should be forced into exile for a period of 10 years? There was no additional penalty towards this person. Their property was protected while away, and when and if they returned, their full citizenship rights were restored. Still, pretty severe to be forced into exile for 10 years. So what's the purpose of ostracism in ancient Athens? Must seem strange to us today, but maybe not. Ostracism was meant to be used against someone who is perceived to be a threat to Athenian democracy. To keep a demagogue, an inspiring tyrant, or the aristocrats from overthrowing the system. It was frequently directed towards perhaps the second most powerful political figure who was a threat to the rulers at the time, and maybe a threat to social stability. In the story of ostracism, there is a great warning as well about the dangers of having a good and respected name. Athens was holding an ostracism vote, and a blind man went in to cast his vote. Helping people at the place where you voted was a man by the name of Aristides the Just. He gained the name the Just for having a reputation of being just that, just and fair. So Aristides approached the blind man and asked him who he would like to vote to ostracize. And the blind man, not seeing who he was talking to, said, Aristides the Just. Well, a shocked Aristides the Just looked at him and asked if he could inquire as to why. And the blind man said that he had never met the guy, but that he was just sick and tired of always hearing about how just he was. So let that, my friends, be a clear warning that even having a good name will come with its consequences. Up to now, the story I've told has consistently shown a single person rise to power with the support of the masses by overthrowing the aristocracy. That man would become sole ruler and forever be known as a tyrant. But that's not what Cleisthenes did. He rose to power with the support of the masses, and yes, he overthrew the aristocracy. But once obtaining power, instead of making himself the sole ruler, he created reforms that would disperse power outwards in a way just not from his own class, but from himself personally. And that's why he's remembered, not as a tyrant, but as the founder of democracy. But what motivated Cleisthenes to do it? We don't know. Cleisthenes came from a wealthy and powerful family in Athens known as the Alcmaeonids. Oftentimes, these were the landed elite being overthrown by the masses. Was Cleisthenes this Christ-like person whose sole purpose was to serve the masses? Maybe. Or maybe he saw the writing on the wall. The previous 100 years in Athens is a story of deep inequality and social upheavals that caused constant political disruptions, a history of coups and counter-coups. He saw the previous aristocratic leaders, himself included, fleeing an angry mob and into exile. Something was going to have to change to alleviate this inequality that led to the unrest. And maybe, just maybe, this was the best deal he thought the rich could get. There was one political body that was left untouched by Cleisthenes, and that was the Areopagus. The Areopagus was made up by exclusively former archons, former leaders from the aristocratic class. The Areopagus was considered the guardian of the laws. It could annul the laws enacted through the democratic process and could hold to account the political leaders who held office. It was like a Supreme Court on steroids. And while most other Athenian political bodies were democratized, the elite still had their Areopagus. And it became a powerful conservative force that thwarted the will of the people expressed through the democratic process. In its day, democracy was seen as, again, ruled by the poor because the majority of the people were poor. But this Areopagus served as a veto on what the masses wanted to do. Again, Cleisthenes kept the power of the Areopagus intact, regardless of all of his other reforms that, again, would sort of see him, and history would see him, as being the founder of democracy. And the rich grudgingly went along with these reforms by Cleisthenes because they knew that they still had the Areopagus.